Rabbi Shlomo, someone was supposed to give an introduction. The guy spoke for 45 minutes. The people who really spoke to speak. But I'm going on the lazy side, so I'm going to actually speak to you a little quickly, say what I want to say, and then be able to sit down with my colleagues so I can rest in the chair. So I really want to talk today, besides just sort of Deborah Hagavi, who I thanks to everybody who organizes the Bahana and have people work with her. Obviously, we all really were greatly appreciative, and I know I can speak for Moshe and Joe, who also saying that this is very easy to work with. So I want to reflect on really one thing and time I have today, which is why we care. Besides the fact it's a nice evening, we come here, somebody says, you know, who cares about the Dead Sea Scrolls? Why does it matter? So, I think that we have to remember that we're talking here about a period in our history for which we had, previous to the scrolls, very little real material. Now, it's not just the scrolls alone. Somehow, something funny happened. There's a lot of material in other books, Josephus, Maccabees, and other texts, what we call the Apocrypha, and other documents, but somehow, until the scrolls were found, there wasn't really an awakening of the wealth and the breadth of Jewish thought in the period of the Second Temple period. Now, when the scrolls stimulated it, they first stimulated it in a way that the truth be told comes to be kind of, they tried to leave them out. But we had our, so to speak, redeemers in some Israeli and American scholars that went before us. And I think personally that it was in 1967 when Yigal Eliezer did found the temple scroll and went on the lecture circuit that he went on, and many of you may have even heard of it at that time. And I can just say that I think he managed somehow or another to turn around a situation where even in Israel, the main people talking about Dead Sea Scrolls were talking about it as if it had nothing to do with Jews, it was some kind of prehistory of Christianity. And what happened is that when that was somehow cracked, and a new generation of Christian scholars got in who understood that it's really Jewish texts about Jews, and that the only way to understand Christianity is to understand the Judaism that came before, so they ended up with the same agenda we have. Let's find out as much as we can about Judaism in the Second Temple period, second first century BCE, begins in the first century CE before the temple was destroyed. And then, I think I would say we got lucky, people in the scrolls field, because the interest caught on. And so many people are really interested in Dead Sea Scrolls. This is an example of why we're here today and why some of us have been involved with other groups in connection with the exhibit as well. So what I want to say is that what we learned, the first thing we learned is the unbelievable breadth of the way Jewish thought was developing at that time. And we see that there were all these groups with different points of view and how they argue. And yet at the same time, we can be interested in Phil and Sifrei Torah and all these things that show us our continuity as Jews, and we can show them to our children. We have school groups that we see here, and we can show them that this really shows that the history we talk about in this period is real. And beyond that, I think we also come to understand certain of the circumstances of the Second Temple period important to us today. You have groups fighting it out ideologically. You eventually have attempts of people to basically revolt against Rome, and failure of that result. And then you have another messianic revolt, which have this kind of extreme messianism coming out of the Barcoca Rebellion. So one of the things we're also learning is about the tremendous political ramifications that sometimes happen when ideological issues spill over into political issues. We've got the chance to see biblical books from a period we never would have had a chance to see them from. We've got the chance, not just looking at Qumran, this is one of the main points that I think actually three of us basically share this idea, that as much as we want to study the scrolls themselves, the scrolls have a lot of relevance for the wider Judaism. And that's why there was so much Jerusalem stuff on the walls on the sides here, so that people would understand that this is happening in the context of a whole live Jewish community. Another thing that I think we learned from the scrolls is, it's not just from the scrolls, but the scrolls maybe give us a great example, that text and artifact go together. We have a colleague who used to be fine, but it's over time. But I think that you see it. You see text, you see artifact. Now, I want to spend a minute explaining something about the Israel Antiquities Authority, and then I'm going to basically do sit down. The Antiquities Authority has put these exhibits together, admittedly with a certain polemical purpose. They want to make the point, don't look at the scrolls as some kind of precursor to something else. Look at the scrolls as something that comes after something else, namely the first temple period. And really, in doing that, they want to make the point that those people think there was no first temple period, who are now rather large numbers of scholars and others, that this is way off base. And the so-called minimalist view, which denies all biblical history, is basically disproven by the things that we saw here. And that's one of the points that they want to make. So it's a combination of continuity and a polemic against that notion. Now, I want to say something funny and then sit down. So our late colleague, Professor Joseph Baumgarten, who was an Orthodox synagogue rabbi who taught at Baltimore Hebrew University, then called Hebrew College, used to joke all the time and say that I'm the only person he knows who makes a whole living out of dead scroll. And I told him, if you just think that, I really make my living at that time as chair in NYU's department, scribble department, even day studying. I would joke and I would say, actually, I make my living pushing papers and not the ones that you read. But he still liked his point that I make my living from condensing scrolls. Well, despite his claims, and despite the fact that I now push more papers at Yeshiva than I used to push at NYU, and look at more numbers and other things like that, the reality is that the three of us here represent a very large group of people. We have a few, one other, I guess you could say, full-timer at Yeshiva, our remarkable student, and we have other people at Yeshiva who in some way have contributed written papers to scroll research. And what I wanted to say is that for us, one of the things that you're seeing here is that there really is now a whole field of Dead Sea Scrolls research. And there are scholars who do, I don't want to say earn their living, dedicate themselves to this. And as a result of it, you'll see whether you look here in the bookstore here or you look online, it's just unbelievable how much really good scholarship, forget all the nonsense that comes out, how much really good scholarship has been written by people. And that's a tremendous accomplishment, which I think many of us are very proud of. And so the last comment I want to make is that while we may look at the literature as a nice place to go to and whatever else, they're a part in educating the public about the results of the research of many, many very fine scholars.
I just want to pick up on one comment that Larry made at the end. And two collections of essays had to come out last week on scrolls. And I was talking with one of my colleagues from Yeshiva, who's also an alumnus of the college, and Fuller, had written an article together with me. And I said, you know, in one of these volumes, there are three essays by Yeshiva College or Yeshiva University alumni. And the other one, there are four out of the 18 essays written by alumni of Yeshiva schools. And it somehow hadn't happened. All of a sudden, we percolated into this field, and we had an identity doing all kinds of different things in universities all over, whether in Israel or the United States. But it's not just the faculty of Yeshiva, but we have a good number of alumni of Yeshiva who aren't on Yeshiva's faculty who are involved in scrolls research as well. All right, so let's start. Tyler. Don't be shy. Otherwise, we're just standing here and tell stories. We don't want to hear that. Mark, yeah.
I don't know if this is exactly related to the scroll, but you know, if someone asked me what my view is on Christianity, I would say that there was a man named Jesus who was Jewish, who at some point in time, during his lifetime, or after, was accepted as whatever it was, and then the religion is based on, based on his followers. A, is this universally accepted today? And B, is this something new, or was this always kind of how it was?
Well, if I, were playing a comedian, I'd say read Shmuley Lotea's book and then read Larry Shimkin's review.
Here's a review here. It's going to come out while Jewish World should be standing, etc. A short version in the Jewish Journal of L.A. and they'll have the long thing on their website.
Okay, so one of the things that scrolls research in the last 40 years have demonstrated, again, picking up on a point that Professor Shimkin made, is that the scrolls are Jewish texts, and whereas the early scroll scholarship was virtually Judenrein, and Jews have been excluded from working on these documents in the early years, and that's why the picture of the scrolls group as a bunch of monks in the desert got all that publicity and still is there today. If you go to the site of Qumran, they're going to tell you there's this historian there where the monks sat and copied. That's probably not what happens. You can't use the tables. The things are the wrong height for copying, and I just have to point it out. But the scrolls and early Christianity really are very divergent. They're very divergent, except insofar as they show that there's a good deal more that's Jewish in early Christianity than there was. But you really can't talk, in the scrolls context, you can't really talk about Jesus. I mean, you had, you know, this, there was a big hullabaloo with the so-called Pierce Messiah text that Eisenman and Weiss were talking about. There was no Messiah, there was no Pierce thing, it was just a misread, you know, they basically misread the text. So, unless you come to the scrolls with a certain agenda, which is, let's see what I can find there about Christianity, the question that you asked, as you said, really is not a scrolls-related question. And there are certain, you know, you talk to scrolls, have a guy called the Teacher of Righteousness, but what does that have to do with Christianity? You have to spend more time talking about what isn't the connection, really, than what is a connection.
Yeah, I'd just like to throw in that one of the scrolls on display here, the Messianic Apocalypse, I'm sure most of you saw it, does provide a chance to see how scrolls can enlighten the world of early Christianity, or illuminate the world of early Christianity. This text, in particular, is practically a recipe of different amazing events that will happen with the coming of Mashiach, written in Aramaic. Hebrew. And of course, this will lead to these many events would include freeing of captives, the blind receiving sight. Of course, all this is an exegesis of Mashiach. However, the one really important one in this text is that the dead will rise. And this is for the first time the Jewish text written prior to Jesus, right? prior to his birth, prior to the rise of Christianity, that you're having Jews talking about Mashiach and resurrection at the same time. This is something that was not known prior to the discovery of the scroll. So it does indeed shed light on the types of Judaism out of which Christianity would ultimately develop.
Why don't we find more scrolls today?
2,000 years in the desert.
Not necessarily in the
Quran. Where? We're lucky to have found what we found, and we must be happy that they found what they found out in Afghanistan, maybe from about 1,000 years later. I mean, we're very fortunate to have found the scrolls. It's an accident. The scrolls let you look over the shoulder of 2,000 years into a Jewish community that we knew almost nothing about. But let's not complain that our good fortune was as limited as it was, because it's really, I mean, maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe, I mean, they did before they turned over that certain areas to the Palestinian Authority. There was a careful resurvey of all the caves led by our good friend Hanan Eshel from Oli Bracha, who went through all the caves that were there that could be gone through that were relevant, looking to see maybe they'll find something. They found almost nothing. A couple of, you know, perhaps some legal things, you know, some thorough. And there are, by the way, legal documents that are found. That stuff we looked at is much fancier. But in the material from the Judean desert more broadly, not necessarily from the 11 caves in Quran, but from the Bar Kokhba period and stretching, let's say, into the 2nd century CE, there is other material that is very, very important, but we don't get, we call it Judean Desert because it is a larger collection of material and we just sort of lump it all together, which is very, very important. It may be important for how documents were written, it may be important for where you see witnesses putting their names, what the Jews call themselves, and all kinds of other things. It's not as glitzy as the War of the Sons of Light, the Sons of Darkness, but there's a lot of nitty-gritty history that can be squeezed out of some of those very fragmentary texts. There's nothing sacred about them, but they're very, very important at the same time.
The scroll discoveries are not true, David, not the way that you might think. We're not finding many things in caves anymore that have been pretty well searched.
but there is a black market out there. Every now and then you'll find, remember a couple of years ago, a new tract of Separate Gardening was published.
Usually people say, I have something, you know, now pay me for it. So we never get to see it until somebody works out the...
I have a friend in finance who just was approached something like this. Somebody who says that he has 20 scrolls or something like this, and he wants some sort of amount of $50 million per scroll or something like this, and,
I mean, there was the Angel Scroll a few years ago, if you remember. And, and supposedly somebody saw it. But, the bubble rises about these things become... There's a whole mythology of scroll stories that people have sort of created over the years. But let's hear more substantive things. Yes, please.
What do you think of that? Some of the scrolls have UK Rumsey and Calvary, Calvary,
Defects, Professor and I were having some argument about this just as we came in. When you write the divine name, you write Trey Mabaya in Calvary, in the ancient script, does that give more sanctity to the manuscript or less sanctity to the manuscript? So in the early days of scroll scholarship, there's no question that if you wrote the Shem in Calvary, it told you it wasn't a biblical manuscript. It was something else. But in the course of time, that's why there were many scholars thought that that scroll of Tehillim that you saw, I don't know how many paid attention to it, because it was just called the Scroll of Songs. Well, that particular scroll, number one, does not have the Mizmorei Tehillim, the Songs of Tehillim, in the same order that we have them in ours. But more important, number two, contains eight pieces of poetry which do not appear in our Sefer Tehillim. So now you have a very, very important question. And this is one of the scrolls that has Shem HaBayah Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei written in Paleo Hebrew script. So you have to say to yourself, okay, have they not closed their book of Tehillim? Were they still accepting compositions into their book of Psalms past the time when the Masoretic Book of Psalms at 150 was closed? Or is this the first art scroll, Moxer from Qumran, that we discovered, and we're looking at as a prayer book rather than a book of the Bible? Now, what it is very important, because it now has ramifications for all kinds of other questions, like when is the biblical canon closed completely? What is your attitude to material written after a certain date? So if it's only a Siddur or a Moxar, okay, big deal. But if it's meant to be a book of Psalms or the book of Psalms, so now I have more than one version of the book of Psalms.
Did they find any listening in Kibbutz in Kavaturi?
Oh yeah, there are a lot of, Tehillim is a Dvarim, Reishis, Shmos, Tehillim, Yeshayahu, I think of the top five, and the book of Jubilees. Ah, what's the book of Jubilees? Well, it's a book written in Hebrew, right? And it's written in the middle of the 2nd century BCE, but it's important enough to that group that there are fragments of 16 copies of it in the caves, which is more than almost all the books of the books of the Bible, other than the five that I mentioned.
Other questions?
What's the meaning of the word?
Yoga.
Yoga. And it's a book that...
It's a retelling of Sefer Arts and Shemites, but it's according to a very particular chronological scheme, and it's measuring time, it's measuring when these events happened, and it's very, if you're a better person to talk about Jubilees, I think, because we have here one of the world iron scholars.
It basically divides up the world history into sets of 50 years. And it then proceeds to date everything. This happened in the fifth year of the third Shemitah cycle in the 14th Jubilee. So everything is done. It's very schematic. They really were into schematic chronology. And it's clear that what's nice about it is it tells you what they thought about halakha, because they also had the patriarchs, the avot, observing halakha. And Jubilees tells me how they were observing it. Very often, as I said to some of you, not in the way that rabbinic halakha is observed the way we may observe it, but very often in a more stringent way. and they tell you some very nice, what we would call midrashim, except they don't appear in bound volumes as it, you know, the midrash says or something, but you have these stories expanding, stories of the Torah, stories of the Avos, some of their adventures, some of their wars, and so on and so forth. This is an early form. If we didn't have it in their written form, we'd call it something resembling, you know, Medrash Shabbat. But it's in the Book of Jubilee, so we have to call it something else.
Do they do, when they're Yovel, do they do 49, 1, 2,
no,
3,
it's just 49. 49. It, that seems to be just 49. No 50s. I understand the question, but no.
How does our Sefer Torah line up with the five books of Moses found there?
All right, that's okay. The answer is yes and no. It's okay. Watch. The fragments of the books of the Torah that we have there belong to different textual families. Some of them, a good percentage of them, not a majority, but a substantial percentage, belong to what we would call ancestors of our text, the Masoretic text. There is another group that lines itself up with what now appears to be the Hebrew text that underlies the Greek translation that we have, the so-called Septuagint. There's another group that aligns itself up with the text on which the Samaritans, the Shomronim, based their tradition. And in addition, you have a whole bunch of so-called unaligned texts that fill in the gaps. In other words, there are all kinds of scrolls, which leads to the question of what do you mean, aren't they copying the text carefully? Aren't they doing everything the Rambam tells you to say the Torah? And the answer is number one, no, they didn't have any copies of the Rambam to say the Torah. Number one. And number two, the notion of what copying means very clearly was not the same in all Jewish circles. So that, for example, if I have a place in the Torah where something is said, Kasher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Lechem, just as the Lord our God, your God, has commanded you. But no place earlier in the Torah do we find that commandment. There are people who would have said, you know what? That is a deficiency and a defect in my Torah. I have to find a place earlier where God made such a commandment. So they go back and they find a place to write it in. Chazal will never touch the text of the Torah, and they will find a place midrashically. Oh, when God said that, that meant that commandment. Both that midrash and that textual feature are responding to the same stimulus. But whereas Rabbinic Judaism does not let you tamper with the sacred text, the view that apparently was held in many Jewish groups, or in the Jewish groups that left us some of the scrolls, was that your job is to go back and fix it. Or if you see a mistake in the text, your job is to fix it. Right? You know, the rabbis' views of textual transmission was of a very, very different nature. So, yes, we end up with things in the Quran that do not look quite like our Sifrei Torah, but in most cases, we can explain the ideology and the methodology that brings them about, or that generates the text that we find at Quran.
I just want to add one point there. The Torah scrolls that you're finding there are already actually Tanakh scrolls. You're already seeing that a large percentage of them are looking like Masoretic text, the text that you're seeing. You're already starting to see a movement towards that. At Qumran, in these early texts. Second of all, we don't have contiguous Torah scroll there, like we have huge scrolls. We have some evidence, I think there's like documents to back up. There's four different connectors. The only one that doesn't appear connected is Bahrain. Okay. But we just don't have that. Our evidence is not what we like, and that's a mantra about scholarship, is that we're dealing here with scraps. We say scrolls, right, but you saw the biggest Devarim scroll on display tonight, and the Ten Commandments scroll, and you see that's the largest one. It's not a big scroll, right? It's a fragment. So we're limited in what we can say also.
Is that the earliest text of the Torah, whatever, that's available in the world?
That particular Devarim scroll is from the first century CE.
Probably a little later than the others. The time period the scrolls are going to cover at best the last part of the 3rd century BCE to the first half of the 1st century CE. So everything is in that very narrow chronological window.
The Yeshayahu scroll, page 1, is from, I think, 2nd century BCE, by the late 2nd century BCE. So that's one of the earliest.
Yeah.
And that is almost a perfect MP. It's a nice
big scroll,
and it's almost a perfect analogy.
I say. It depends on what you want it to be. There are a lot of features in it. Yeah, it's got everything that it should have, but there are a lot of textual features where the writer of that scroll, which is the first one to be discovered, everybody went all crazy about it in the early 1950s, where the scribe who wrote that probably spoke as much Aramaic as he did Hebrew. And as a result, there are a lot of funny spellings in it which occur because the scribe knew Aramaic or was bending over backwards to write Hebrew so it shouldn't look like Aramaic. And there are a lot of linguistic features that you don't always think about when you look at these texts. You're looking at a text coming out of a bilingual society, and sometimes the native language or the native speech of the scribe is going to interfere with what he's doing.
What about the authorship? Can you tell by the stylistic way it's written or the handwriting whether these were multiple authors, one group, or etc.?
You mean of the scribes of the scrolls?
Yeah.
There are a few scrolls where we know or we think that a single guy wrote more than one scroll. But what's remarkable is that you don't have a small group of scribes writing all of these. You've got but almost as many scribes as you have manuscripts. And that's one of the things that really undercuts the notion of this, there being a scriptorium with a few monks copying all these things, because the handwritings are just so divergent and diverse.
To go back to the prior question, prior to discovery of the scrolls, let's say, now you're saying you have parts of the Torah that were written around year zero, right?
Copy.
There's no question that they did.
We use the term copy because it means something else. Yeah, okay, that's good. It's a white event. We all understand that.
So, but prior to that, what did we have that you said this is copied to you? Was it in the year 400?
Okay, the earliest
500.
We have. It's really stuck in what, 7th century? Biblical manuscripts. No, the before Quran, the only stuff we have is. So you have the Nash Papyrus, which is 2nd century BCE or something like that, which is just basically the Asarat HaDibrot. But when you talk about it, you want to know what we have in terms of biblical manuscripts. So the stuff, the earliest stuff we had, 7th, 8th century for fragments, the earliest complete text would be either the Aleppo Codex or the Leningrad Codex, which is, let's say, 9th, 10th century.
This is like 500 years earlier.
This is 1,000 years earlier.
Thousands.
It's 1,000 years earlier, more or less, than what we have.
I'm having a problem, obviously, because, you say Torah Misinai, and yet these people copied by hand and they made mistakes, obviously. But when was the Masoretic text that we follow today that people use established?
Fair question. And so the answer is, I'll put on one hat and I'll say, well, the day after Matan Torah, of course.
Yeah, but
the fact is, please remember, the Torah the Malach Yashar race. The Torah was given to human beings. Did you ever play telephone?
Yes.
Did you ever play telephone? Well, the transmission of a written text is a game of telephone. And I will tell you a story that took place in our shul. We bought a new Sefer Torah, and it was computer checked. And I have a copy of the computer check with all of the mistakes that the Sofer made in copying this text. And let me tell you, any mistake that a scribe made in Quran, this Sofer made in copying this text. And so from Guy, went to Mikveh, recording, did all the things we wanted to do. But there is a computerized check, and we go through it, and the Sofer goes through it, and he corrects all of the mistakes, and I now have a computer printout of the mistakes. and it's written Hakol Baruch Uvetukan, everything has been checked and corrected. And further down, another guy has signed Hakol Baruch Uvetukan, checked and corrected. And we buy the scroll. It cost a good amount of money. It's a magnificent Sefer Torah. And a few weeks after it's been used for the first time, and I got to tell the story in class with the young man who's involved sitting in the back of the room in introduction to the Bible one day. And the Balkori begins to read, and in someplace in Vayikra, and he reads in at the beginning of one of the Chatal in the Vayikra, in Kartalan, I think, and the entire Sibur yells out, the in, and he, being trained properly, reads what's in front of him, and he reads in, and everybody screams to him, and he points. Folks, this was computer checked, it was human checked, it was Hakol Baruch Uvetukan, and it was above missing. The transmission of the text of the Torah is as fine as is humanly possible. But you have to realize that if the rules of copying were not the same in some communities, and if human beings copy it, and we know very well that Chazal at times misquote Pesukim also, for whatever reasons. So it shouldn't terrify us. The fact that we find certain data of this kind should not stir our emunah, should not disturb our faith. The fact is the text is remarkably well preserved, and that errors are not allowed to creep in because of the way the text is copied. But can you guarantee, I like to read to my students a passage written by Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg of Eretz Yisrael, who in his book on the Yud Gimel Lichrim of Rambam writes very explicitly, and I always tell my students to be quoted with Yaakov Weinberg, it's like the devil quoting scripture. But he writes very clearly, you know, after generations of copying and copying and copying and copying, it's very unlikely that our Sefer Torah is exact in every detail with the Sefer Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. Period, end quote, and done. Right? I'm just going to go to the bus, go ahead, Torah, and quote one of them to indicate that. Don't worry about it. When the Rambam writes what he wrote, he knew what he was writing. He also writes, I know there's a whole dispute among different Sifrei Torah, so I'm going to tell you what I think it should look like based on the manuscript that we believe to be the Aleppo manuscript, which the Rambam writes, I copied this. And by the way, because that manuscript doesn't match your Sifrei Torah, people have edited the words of Halacha of the Rambam. Oh, and they've changed the Rambam not to say what the Rambam wrote. How do we know what the Rambam wrote? Because we have a copy of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, which he signs and says, this was copied from my book, I, Moshe Ben Maimon. This is an authorized copy of my Mishnah Torah. And I know what he wrote, my Hasidu was supposed to be written. But our Sifrei Torah I've written that way. And God forbid you should change your Sifrei Torah to match the Rambam, because that would violate our Masorah. Sorry,
run
off like that.
No,
it's a very important question. So did that everybody knows the one difference of Dr. with an L and Dr. with a H? But that's not the only difference. I mean, that just shows you there is a difference. Right? And there are places in when Rabbi Breuer prints the Tanakh that he prints a number of places. Mordechai Breuer prints the Tanakh. There's a place in Breishis where I think we have Vayehi and he has Vayehu. And okay, and that's what do you do with this? Machlokas Masorah. And Judaism, Yiddishkeit has lived with Machlokas in all kinds of areas. A little Machlokas here and there we can live with as well. Not too much in these areas, I hope, but a little bit we can survive. Yeah. I always joke that I put on my biggest, blackest hat when I go in to teach this area. Because this you get students who are very much come out of a certain kind of worldview. You look at the Tanakhs that we have printed, they agree about 99.99%. But the fact that theologically we sometimes create bigger chumras in theology than we do in halacha is also something that we have to think about. But professors can't do anything about that.
Yeah.
The scroll contains some more surprises that we haven't heard about. Is the study continuing of the scroll, the new thing? Or is it finished?
It's not talking about the Bible, but there are a lot of new things. In other words, right? I pick the stuff that you work on.
We've got a series of magical techniques, which mention a whole slew of shaky demons, and they have their own particular way of getting out of the conundrum of the shoot, right? how do you do magic and not be able to just come and stuff? They actually go through prayer. And we're trying all sorts of liturgical tactics and
responding to questions about the nature of the biblical text, but even more, talking about the differences between Qumran Judaism and Rabbinic Judaism. What we don't always spend enough time, and this is something that Professor Shiffman has really stressed in a lot of his writing, what I'll call the pan-Jewish aspect of so much that I find at Qumran. So the notion of saying Kedusha with the angel, whether you say Keser or Naritzkar or Nakdishak or whatever, but that notion is all over the Quran prayer text. The idea of reading the Bible, interpreting it in certain ways, is very much shared. We spend a lot of our time, especially in sort of popular audiences, talking about, you know, what are the differences? But if we think about what is the same, then we really get a much better picture for the things that unify Judaism and whatever manifestations it may have had in the late Bayetshini and early Chazal period, rather than the things that, you know, Jews are always looking for what's different from one another, what makes them more alike one another. And you can take both sides of Qumran, you can use it to look at what uniquely defines the different groups of Jews from one another, or you can use it to look at the ways in which Klal Yisrael had a certain kind of unity back then.
We're going to work together to get the kinds of information that you just see quickly without realizing how much it took to analyze and understand. So I think all of us, that's why we sort of feel a great feeling of satisfaction when we come in, especially on a crowded Sunday, is feel there's people looking at the stuff, and you realize that there really is an audience for what we do. And so as I sit down, I thank you for being part of that audience.